Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Before I launch too much into details, I want to give a brief exposition of the main points of this talk. You can kind of think of this as a map, as it were, so that if I digress from the text too much, because I'm a professor and I tend to digress. In fact, I know one of my classes, they wrote a whole group chat for the class and it was called I Digress. So if I digress from the text, no laughs. I really lost you with the Oregon thing, didn't I? Okay. So if I digress from the text or you lose the train of this argument, you can follow the breadcrumbs back to where we left off the trail, or you might even be able to find a shortcut and cut me off onto to where this is all going. So let's begin with the first part of the title of this talk, Catholic culture. What is Catholic culture? John Senior, who is a professor at the University of Kansas, in his famous Death of Christian Culture in 1979, defined it very simply as the Mass. From its institution at the Last Supper to the 12:30 p.m. daily at the campus center here to the eternal wedding feast of the Lamb, the Mass is the source and summit of all Christian culture. So there's a lot of work that has to be done to kind of prove that. I'm just going to lay that out there and say that's what it is. You can take it for what it is. From the Mass flows and is redirected all aspects of the church's culture. By this, I mean both the material culture, that is our clothing, our architecture, our art, its creative culture, the church's music and storytelling and language, its ethical and social norms, the way we move our bodies, the laws that bind us together, sit, stand, kneel, you know, grab the holy water from the font, right? These are all cultural things. And our intellectual habits of thought. This is something that we normally don't think of when we talk about culture. But the intellectual habits of thought, how we train the minds of our followers, and to what, or to rather, to whom we orient that education. So I shall pay special attention to the relationship between culture and the virtues in this talk, both moral and intellectual. And finally, I shall turn to Tolkien as a practical exemplar of how you and I are called to inhabit Catholic culture in the 21st century. So I'm afraid this means that I'm going to have to beg your attention a bit before we actually get into the nitty-gritty of Tolkien, right? So as a kind of compensation, I would like to begin, before we launch off into the virtues and culture, with a discussion of Catholic culture by sharing an extended passage from Tolkien's letter to his son Michael in 1967. So the letter runs thus, and it has a core image here that I want to maintain throughout this talk. Because primitive Christianity is now, and in spite of all research, ever will remain largely unknown, because primitiveness is no guarantee of value and was in great part a reflection of ignorance, grave abuses were as much an element in Christian liturgical behavior from the beginning as now. St. Paul's strictures on Eucharistic behavior are sufficient to show this. Still more, because my church, that is the Catholic Church, was not intended by our Lord to be static or remain in perpetual childhood, but to be a living organism likened to a plant, which develops and changes in externals by the interaction of the bequeathed divine life and history, the particular circumstances of the world into which it is set. There is no resemblance between the mustard seed and the full-grown tree. For those living in the days of its branching growth, the tree is the thing. For the history of a living thing is part of its life, and the history of a divine thing is sacred. The wise may know that it began with a seed, but it is vain to try and dig it up, for it no longer exists. And the virtue and the powers that it had now reside in the tree. Very good. But in husbandry, the authorities, the keepers of the tree, must look after it, according to such wisdom as they possess, prune it, remove cankers, rid it of parasites, and so forth. With trepidation, knowing how little their knowledge of growth is, but they will certainly do harm if they are obsessed with the desire of going back to the seed or even to the first youth of the plant when it was, as they imagined, pretty and unafflicted by evils. The other motive, now so confused with the primitive one, even in the mind of any one of the reformers, aggiornamento, bringing up to date, that is what aggiornamento means, bringing up to date, that has its own grave dangers, as has been apparent throughout history. So great, that's the quote there. This image of Tolkien's is an image of him discussing the mass, right? So it's 1967. You can imagine this is the height of the beginnings of the talks of liturgical reforms and what's given us the Novus Ordo. I'm going to extend by way of John Senior's definition of Christian culture, that is, if Christian culture is the mass, and this image of the mass and the culture of the mass is one of the mustard seed in the tree, I'm just going to take that image, and I would like you to keep that in the back of your mind for the central image behind the integration of the disparate aspects of virtue, which I'm going to be describing, right? So we can get kind of lost in the weeds in one aspect or another, but keep in mind that, you know, you have the flower, you have the fruit, you have the various buds and branches and stems, you have the core, you have the outer cortex of the tree, you have the roots, right? So there are all these aspects, and we can talk about all these aspects, but again, there's kind of a risk there when we take apart the tree to talk about the various aspects, we've essentially killed the living tree, right? It's only seen when it's functioning as a whole. So let's just keep that in mind. And of course, you can never recover the seed, right? And to think that you can recover the seed by uprooting the tree and tearing through everything is just an absurdity. All right, so to begin again, right, with the larger issue at hand, what is culture? All right, without the presumption that you agreed with the definitions above, the question becomes multiple. What is Catholic culture? Before that, what is culture to begin with? What is today's definition of culture? What are some of the historical definitions of culture? Are these compatible? Is there a true definition beneath all the talking points? If we can arrive at some agreed definition of culture, why does culture matter? That is, what is at stake when we talk about culture? After 2,000 years across languages among 1.4 billion people practicing it today, can there be any unity to Catholic culture? That is a very clear point, right? The idea that, like, we have this Catholic culture and that Tolkien's going to illuminate something about it, right? How can we, as disparate as we are, we're talking about, like, different, dialects and preferences and diets between, like, Midwesterners and East Coasters and people in Seattle, right? Like, we think of these as all distinct cultures, right? How can there be any sort of unity that can bind us? How can you be united in culture with St. Paul and St. Francis of Assisi and today? So if we can solve this problem of an internal unity within a culture, right, that is, if we can define, okay, here is Catholic culture, there still presents us the problem of, can this culture of Catholicism coexist with a culture such as being an American, right? If there's such a thing as American culture, right, or British culture in Tolkien's sense, must it exclude Catholic culture? So I'm going to confess at this moment, it's my hope that by beginning with this salvo of questions, I hope that you're a little confused, a little muddled on the idea of the topic of culture. As a human being, culture is all around you. And to notice it at all is like detecting the shadow of a thought or to feel the weight of air. Right? This is a problem, right? Because we're culture-making animals, right? It's to think about thinking, right, leads to further redundancies and ad absurdums. So what is culture? Let's start with a definition, right? For the purpose of this talk, at least for what I'm going to take, culture is a collective term to describe the shared physical, moral, and intellectual habits of a community and the works that result from these habits. The English Catholic novelist Evelyn Waugh had a good rule, that he never trusted a thought or a sentence that could not be translated back into Latin. I think this also applies at times to the definitions of words, especially words derived from Latin. So culture comes from the Latin word cultura. I'm a little tied down to this whole phone thing here. Cultura. But it itself is just an extended form of the more commonly used word cultus. Our sense of cultura as culture can be found as far back as the Tusculan disputations of the Roman orator, statesman, and philosopher Cicero. But at the same time, if you look, you know, in the larger uses as a classicist, right, the more common word for what we would define as culture is cultus, right? So this is kind of for the uber nerds in the audience, right? Cultura is less common, but cultus is really the same definition. The problem becomes in English, right? Both of them, cultura and cultus, come from the Latin word colo. Colo is a verb. It means to cultivate or to till the soil, right? And so metaphorically, it can mean to cultivate or till not just the soil, but, a certain way of dressing, a certain way of cooking your food, a certain way of acting or carrying yourself about, whether it's slouching or standing up straight, whatever that is, right? This agricultural sense is retained in the word agriculture, obviously. The more common Latin term cultus, unfortunately, in English has become this very limited word, right? The cult, where in Latin it does refer to the care or cultivation of a divinity. But in English in the 15th century, culture emerged as this one that defines both agriculture and human endeavor, right? However, I should point out that the use of the word culture as a common term, right, does not really begin until the 19th century. And then those of you who are kind of language nerds, and again, Tolkien was the philologist, right? He's a lover of languages. A really useful tool is engrams, right? Running massive searches on databases. And one of these things that you can do is run an engram search on like the use of the word culture. And you kind of see like, it's not actually a very common word until about the 1850s. And then all of a sudden we start talking about it. And what we have to understand is that there are words that we used to use for culture that fell off. Words like religion, words like education, words like art, which seen a decline in use, used to be much more common. So I want to just point out a couple of other synonyms, right, to give you a sense of the wide range of what we mean when we talk about culture, right? So first of all, in Latin, you could talk about the mos, or in plural, the mores of a people. Now, today, this gives us our English word moral, right? And so we confine it to ethical decision-making realm. But the mores of the people that can be invoked in Latin literature and culture is also just like, we don't do that in this. Oh, is it the Marvel kids, right? You GIF, right? The Black Panther turns to whatever. We don't do that here. We don't do that here, right? Like this sort of like, we don't, you know, this is not the way you carry yourself. This is not the way you speak. This is not the whatever. It's not necessarily a law. We just don't do that here, right? There's other words that you could use, like urbanitas, right? That is, there's a idea of culture, which is not just, like, everyone possesses a culture. We're culture-making animals. But there's also a preferential option sometimes in our expression, right? He's very cultivated, she's very civilized, right? This idea that some cultures are better than another, right? And we're not going to really get into the weeds of that. That's obviously a very contentious issue. But historically, one of the ways that we understood this was that there's sort of, like, you know, the people who practice agriculture, right? And that's their culture. And then there's those of us who are in the city. And so we exhibit what would be called urbanitas. And urbanitas is just being urban, right? That as I'm part of the city here, right? For the Greeks, this would be known as paideia, but also ethne or ethnos, this habits of a people, right? So it covers such a large range of topics. It's really hard to understand, like, is there a Catholic way to eat, right? And at first you think, no, that's not really something that covers Catholicism. And then you have to understand that, like, the massive economic weight that Catholicism actually has, because February 14th, besides being Valentine's Day this year, is also Ash Wednesday, right. And so what you're going to see are billboards all up and down, right, that are going to be telling you that fast food chains are now selling fish, right? This idea of like fish sandwiches, like, yeah, the, you don't need to know the names of them. I'm not giving free promotion to any of them, right? But like all the fast food chains are going to start putting up billboards that like they're going to sell fish, right? None of them ever acknowledge like, hey, you're probably abstaining from meat on Fridays because it's Lent. But all of them recognize the economic impact of this religious practice that finds itself in this cultural phenomenon. I hesitate to say cultural phenomenon around a McFish, but that's what it is, right? So there's another word, and I kind of want to leave this as something that goes back to that image of the tree. Another word that we could use instead of culture would be tradition, right? Now, the important thing here in understanding tradition is that it's often a misunderstood word. A tradition that only looks back to the past is no tradition because we are not concerned with the handing on towards the future. And this is the problem. Tradition means a handing on, right? And so if I'm only concerned, you know, any of you guys play track, right? Run track, yeah. You know that like in the relay races, right? It's not just about like the skill with which you like grab the baton from someone behind you. It's also about timing it correctly to hand the baton to the person in front of you, right? And I think this is a largely misconstrued and misunderstood idea about tradition, is that tradition is both what you've inherited and equally as well a disposition to carry forward what is living, right? So that tree, right, we shouldn't be, again, like as beautiful and great a tradition bonsai is, right? With our mustard seed and our tree, we should not be so concerned with preserving the tree the size that it is. It's meant to grow into this large tree. So if we're constantly being like, oh, no, the mustard tree keeps growing on me. Well, yeah, it's supposed to grow, dummy, right? And this is part of tradition. All right. I'm going to not do Tolkien here for a second and something else entirely. But as a classicist, it seems that there's a wonderful speech if you have a chance to ever read it, and it's called it's in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, and it's the funeral oration that Pericles gives over the Athenian dead. And there's a section in there that I think is an excellent summary of what I'm trying to capture here in tradition. I will speak first of our ancestors, for it is right and seemly that now, when we are lamenting the dead, a tribute should be paid to their memory. There has never been a time when they did not inhabit the land, which by their valor they will have handed down from generation to generation, and we have received from them a free state. But if they were worthy of praise, still more were our fathers who added to their inheritance, and after many a struggle transmitted to us, their sons, this great empire. And we ourselves assembled here today, who are still most of us in the vigor of life, have carried the work of improvement further and have richly endowed our city with all things, so that she is sufficient for herself both in grace, in peace, in war. Of the military exploits by which our various possessions were acquired, of the energy with which our fathers drove back the tide of war, Hellenic or barbarian, I will not speak, for the tale would be long and familiar to you. This idea of like, it's known to us, and the idea is not just that it goes back and you are possessing it in trust for something that's going to be handed further on. And I think one of the problems that we have in the church, especially for those of us who, I'm a millennial, you guys are Gen Z, soon we're going to have Gen Alphas coming next after that, pretty soon. Although there's still people who work in the church who refer to, like, you know, people who are in college as millennials, which is weird because the millennials are usually middle-aged professors at this point. Leave that aside. But the idea is that like we grew up in some ways with a loss of tradition or a multiplicity of traditions. You're trying to reinvent tradition and you're trying to reach back, right? And so it's one of these weird things where, you know, as me, I have five children. I'm trying to pass on Catholicism to them, but I'm also part of a broken branch, as it were, right? And so I've been, you can do this with, you know, certain bushes and stuff like that. You can, you know, breaking of the branch, and then you can reap, you know, you can allow it to grow roots again, right? But it's no longer part of that same tree, and there's problems, right? And so most of us find ourselves disrupted in our Catholic culture outside of the liturgical culture, which continues on, right? That is, a lot of the things that are used to be done are just not done anymore. I mean, how many people chalk their doors after Epiphany? Good for you guys. But it's very few, very random, right? What I'm trying to say here is that there's this tradition, but the tradition can't happen by yourself, right? You can't go on like the back end of the web and find out like random YouTube videos of like how to be a traditional Catholic or something like that. I mean, you can. Unfortunately, it's filled with that, right? But it's not actually a tradition, right? That would be like me watching like an Olympic baton race and then like, you know, imitating that like in my living room or whatever in my pajamas and trying to grab a baton, but it's not there. It's not living. There's no connection, right? Same way that, like, again, as sacramental people, as we believe in the church, right, there needs to be a tradition that's a handing on, that you see that, like, so clearly in confirmation or the physical imposition of hands, right? And you think about that, like, goes back, that tradition, that physical touch, that plant that's growing, right? And so what we have to do is talk about, okay, well, there are lots of different traditions we can cultivate, but there's also a deathly thing that we can cultivate, which is, for the ancient Greeks, is to be an idiot. And most of us don't know what idiot means anyway. Idiot is related to the English word idiom, right? And idiom, if you're idiomatic, right, means that you are by yourself, right? That is, you are law unto yourself. The Cyclops in the Odyssey is an idiot, right? Because he doesn't care about anyone else, right? And so one of the problems we have in today's culture is we have a culture of idiots. Come on, like, this is Seattle, all right? And I love you guys. I grew up in the 90s, right? And the fact is like, you guys had for a time a culture. It was in like, you know, garages. It was in like, you know, dank bars. And then all of a sudden this individualistic culture, right? Again, idiots. Right? Like, that, like, I'm such an individual, is mass branded. It's in PacSun. It's in the mall. Everyone's wearing, like, you know, the keychain wallets and they got the studded, like, neck things. I mean, like, how is that an individual expression when everyone else is doing it? And it's, I don't know. Anyway, sorry. I'm going to step off that hobby horse here and come back. Okay. So today's culture, right? We have like this idea of this smorgasbord of culture, right? The idea that like, I can pick and choose. I can run into whatever race I want to run and just grab the baton, right? And I can, you know, I see this all the time in the church of like, well, now I'm going to be like in this clique or that clique. And there's, you know, like the loss of family traditions, the loss of sort of the unfreedom, which is the true tradition of being born in a certain place in a certain time, and living with that, because we're trying to do what Tolkien said not to do. We're trying to go back to the mustard seed, right? You can't find the mustard seed. Here you are. Here's the tree. What are you going to do with it? Okay, I should probably switch over at this point to talk about a little more clearly what we talk about here, especially since it's a Thomistic Institute talk, Catholic culture and, you know, sort of the virtues and Aquinas and how does those all tie together, right? So culture then, if it's tradition, has to fit in some ways with the virtues, right? And I'm going to just, for the purpose of this talk, lightly touch on a couple of them. But the four cardinal virtues of justice and temperance, as well as prudence and fortitude, right, all have a kind of tradition about them. For prudence and fortitude, this is a side note, and you can ask me afterwards if you're interested in it. I would say that the imagination is what is important when it comes to Aquinas and understanding the exercise of both prudence and fortitude when it comes to traditions or culture. But when it comes to tradition or culture, let's talk about justice and temperance here. Okay, I find that very interesting. Justice is a matter of the will to render to another person what is due to them, right? Now, sometimes what is due to them, right? I arrive here in Washington, in Seattle, and I just start taking things from stores, right? Just kleptomaniac type thing. I don't know. Some umbrellas, maybe some like Huskies jerseys or like, I don't know. What else would I take here? Some random coffees. And I just appropriate them to myself, right? Like injustice, if you came to me injustice to render to me what was due to me, right, would probably be what? Jail, something like that. It's Seattle. So, okay. All right. Well, to give me a fine, to give some sort of penalty to say to this person, again, like as a double injustice, right? As Plato says, right, for the unpunished bad evildoer, right? The person who does wrong and is unpunished is punished twice, right? And so you do an injustice to them by not giving them some sort of punishment. When it comes to tradition, right, tradition is something that someone's handed on to you, right? There are some traditions, right? If I come from a family of axe murderers, right, that we don't carry on. We just let them die, right? That's a part of the branch of the mustard tree. Yeah, I just went there. I know. So like, that's not really a tradition. It's not something that's worthy of anything. I'm sorry, that was a really extreme example. They can probably edit that one out too. I hope so too. But if I came from a family that, like a criminal family, right? Again, like I'm from New Jersey, right? These things exist. If I come from a criminal family, that's a tradition that like injustice, right? If I have a will to render to them what is due, I would step away from. There are other traditions like Thanksgiving, like showing up and cooking some small dish, right? That injustice that's due to them, right? I may not want to because it's easier for me to stay home and doom scroll. It's easier for me to like go and hang out with this person I'm interested in, but my friends all know that like I am constantly flaky and I'm not really gonna stick around with this person. And so I'm just upsetting my family by not showing up for Thanksgiving because I'm a horrible person. Again, justice, right? Justice there is to show up for Thanksgiving dinner, to call your mother, right? So they can keep that in the podcast, right? Again, call your mother, okay? That's a good tradition, right? And that's what is just. That tradition is there. Another aspect of justice for St. Thomas Aquinas is religion, right? That is, religion is separate but similar to justice and is a subset in the sense that we owe something to God, right? And to render to him what is due to him is justice. So when we have tradition in the Catholic Church, that tradition is going to be a matter of justice, right? Now, there's that in one aspect of tradition. The other aspect of tradition when it comes to like food or the way that I dress is a matter of temperance, right? That is, there are certain traditions that regulate food and speech and song and language and everything else like that that have to do with bodily desires. And the regulation of that, I would argue, falls culturally under temperance. So culture is kind of this weird thing because it's such a large, broad thing that it falls into so many different places, right? And of course, we live in this culture where, again, it's a wonderful time where we can kind of eat and choose anything that we want, right? I can go to Grubhub and I can order various cuisines of all different kinds, yeah? And yet at the same time, do I have a tradition in my own house, right? So we can add others in, but it's a problem. Okay, so last thing and then we'll get to Tolkien. Tradition is also about intellectual habits. Culture is about intellectual habits, right? To be cultivated and to come to university, it's not just about getting a job, right? That there's a way of entering into our culture, which is partly learning our habits of thought. And there has to be a kind of intellectual humility of allowing someone, usually not someone you know, like a professor, right? To say, this is the way that it has been done. Take what is useful, perfect your own, and pass it on, right? This idea of perfecting intellectual habits, of ways of thought, of reason, is something that I would argue is part of culture, right? That is, cultural ways in which we rationalized our decisions. Okay. Now, looking at the time, what I really want to focus on now is looking at Tolkien and trying to understand my one beef with Tolkien when it comes to culture, and then the three things that I think Tolkien knocks out of the park that I really hope are going to inspire you when you leave. My one beef with Tolkien is that if you are a Lord of the Rings nerd, right, religion, right, is largely absent. And he talks about this explicitly in his letters, right? That Eru Iluvatar, so who's a Lord of the Rings nerd? Great. You're awesome. You're in great company. I affirm you, right? This is like a, we can all come up afterwards and say our names and talk about like how many times we've read Lord of the Rings. Anyone read The Silmarillion though? Yes, and then you hit the names. It's like I'm going to read the Bible in a year. Get through Genesis, get through Exodus, and that's why you got to listen to something like, you know, Father Mike Schmitz's Buy One of Your Podcasts or something like that, where it like breaks it apart. And it, again, this is not paid for by Ascension Press, but you gotta break that apart. That Leviticus is really gonna do a number on you. That's a pun. In The Silmarillion, what we see is Eru Iluvatar, which is really more of a title than who he is, right? Is the monotheistic god, right? And since there's not any divine revelation, there's no proper way of knowing how to worship. So actually going back to the Pentateuch, right? The reason the Jews know how to worship the way that they do is because we have the Pentateuch, which tells you very explicitly, this is what you're going to wear. This is how you're going to construct everything. This is the incense you're going to use, and so on and so forth, right? Well, in Tolkien's concession that this is sort of a prehistory of everything, there is no divine, there's only room for one divine revelation, and that's not given to the elves, right? And so the elves don't really worship properly, and they don't have proper religion. Tolkien makes a distinction that they might have prayers of thanksgiving, but they don't have prayers of petition because that's not been, there's no idea of Jesus Christ yet. So there's no idea that God became man and he wants to redeem us, right? And the children of God, which is human beings, they don't worship properly either, except for when Sauron corrupts them and then they do satanic worship and they, you know, that's a whole human sacrifice thing. And that's a, I don't know if that's quote unquote religion in Tolkien, right? I think he sees it as sort of definitely an anti-religion, right? So there's this one beef I have, which is, okay, that's fine, right? You Tolkien's saying, all right, there's no divine revelation for the elves. There's no divine revelation except for what the Valar, who are these angelic beings, reveal, right? But they can't really say much, right? And on a natural law perspective, like a Thomistic perspective, so if Aquinas is like sitting down, like, and you know, Tolkien gets to heaven and he sits down and have a pint with Aquinas, there's another pun in there. And Aquinas is hashing things out. He's like, so tell me this story that you got, JRR. Right? And Aquinas is like, well, wait a second, time out. Right? In justice, in religion, religion is a natural virtue, right? That is, we can know by the light of reason that there is a God. We know that, like, in justice, we owe him worship, right? So there's this idea of like, okay, well, that's a little tricky. But what I find exciting, and I want to get into, is what I call the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to culture and Tolkien, right? So before we depart, I would like to end with three hot takes from Tolkien on culture. So I call them the good, the bad, and the ugly, and we're going to proceed in reverse order. So we're going to start with the ugly. Tolkien in his letters and hinted at in his description of the technology and globalization of Saruman was a great opponent of standardization. If we have any economists in the audience, you might find yourself at odds with Tolkien on this. Standardization in machines and industry have lifted the world out of poverty. The cargo container, the great instrument of standardization, brings you strawberries in January, and the same style of sweater can be found both in Seattle, in Wichita, in Boston, Jacksonville, Rome, London, so on and so forth, right? In fact, this past March, I was in Rome, and they lost my luggage. And I was like, oh, this is great. I'll have an excuse to buy something that's unique and it's from Rome. And I was like, no, the stores here have the same things I can buy back home. So this is kind of standardization. Same way, like I arrive here in Seattle. I feel uncomfortable trying to find food. Oh, look, there's a Chipotle, right? And they're going to say of the same menu that I have 3,000 miles away. So if you'll indulge me, I want to read a bit from a letter from Tolkien to his son Christopher in 1943 to give you, like, this is what he's saying. The bigger things get, the smaller and duller or flatter the globe gets. It is getting to be all one blasted little provincial suburb. When we have introduced American sanitation, moral prep, feminism, and mass production throughout the Near East, Middle East, Far East, USSR, the Pampas, El Gran Chaco, the Danubian Basin, Equatorial Africa, hither further in inner Mumbo Land, Guanahana Land, Lhasa, and the villages of darkest Berkshire, how happy we shall be. Right? There's a McDonald's everywhere, right? We live in this wonderful time. At any rate, it ought to, this is going back to Tolkien, at any rate, it ought to cut down travel. There will be nowhere to go. This is like for me today, very experienced. All right, land in Seattle. There's a Chipotle. Why did I fly this far to just eat at Chipotle? There'll be nowhere to go. So people will, I opine, go all the faster. Colonel Knox says 1/8 of the world's population speaks English, and that is the biggest language group. If true, damn shame, say I. May the curse of Babel strike all their tongues till they can only say ba, ba, ba. It would mean much the same. I think I shall have to refuse to speak anything but Old Mercian. And this is Tolkien. He loves these old languages. Mercian is this dialect in like the northwest corner of England. And he's saying like if everyone starts speaking English, I'm going to speak Mercian. In fact, it's a trivial thing, but when they changed the language in mass to the vernacular, or allowed the vernacular, I should say more properly, Tolkien used to shout the responses in Latin. Look, the point that Tolkien's making here, and he's being really harsh, and I want to show you he's a little harsh, and he's being a little bit of a curmudgeon, and that's okay. But in the words of St. John Paul II in his encyclical Unum Sint, this is an encyclical on ecumenism, unity does not imply uniformity. In fact, if there was uniformity, it would be monstrous. If you were all stomach or all right kneecap, right? It would be gross and disgusting, right? That is, there can be unity to a thing, and the unity can be beautiful and necessary, but it does not necessarily have to imply uniformity. So again, like the example I could bring up is like the sort of like grunge culture, which then sort of like revolved itself into like, it used to be like, you know, distinct things like flannel pajamas and weird other stuff. And then it all kind of homogenized over time, right? All right, so that's the thing. It might mean a little bit of poverty, and you guys are students, so like there's just a case of like I can't always have, although it's the Pacific Northwest, this is artisanal everything here if you go to the right hipster, right? Although I'm not sure I want like, you know, artisanal iPads, but the point is that Tolkien's saying the standardization presents a problem in culture, right? Because there's a uniformity that prevents any distinct culture from existing. So that's the ugly. Let's turn to the bad. And by the bad, I mean Disney. Some Tolkien enthusiasts in the audience might know, for example, that C.S. Lewis and Tolkien went to see Disney's Snow White in 1938. Both left the theater disgusted and hated it. And a year before that, Tolkien was considering the American publication of The Hobbit and was pressed to find an illustrator. So here's Tolkien on the subject. As for the illustrations, I am divided between knowledge of my own inability and fear of what American artists, doubtless of admirable skill, might produce. It might be advisable, rather than lose the American interest, to let the Americans do what seems good to them. As long as it was possible, I should like to add, to veto anything from or influenced by the Disney studios, for all of whose works I have a heartfelt loathing, right? It's one of these things where, like, if Tolkien was, like, presented with, like, a contract, right, it would be, like, almost like before baptism, like, do you reject Disney and all of his empty lies and promises, right? So in a different letter, I think there's a larger philosophical reasoning that Tolkien's arriving at in terms of the aesthetics of the culture that he's saying, right? So in this other letter, Tolkien's discussing at length children and children's literature and the whole abomination that is the idea of a separate literature reserved for children, right? And so I think we're going to find a better context for the Disney comment, right? So this letter dates from 1961. Tolkien writes, "I think that this writing down, flattening, Bible in basic English attitude," and this is like around the time where you have like Goodnight Moon, right? Like, goodnight comb, goodnight oatmeal, goodnight moon, right? This sort of like flattening down of like everything as opposed to like the gravity and the beauty that the Bible can have, right? This attitude is responsible for the fact that so many older children and younger people have little respect and no love for words and very limited vocabularies. And alas, little desire left, even when they had the gift which had been stultified, to refine or enlarge them. Right, this is an important point, right? That because we've lowered the standards so far, we've left you nothing to aspire to. We've created this not just standardized, but bastardized and culture that we feed ourselves on. And so we have no taste. It's like, you know, I don't know, when you guys were kids, you went into the movies, you eat, like, your parents bought you, like, maybe, this is all an anecdote from my own life, by the way. Like, the big thing of Sour Patch Kids, right? Yeah, the huge thing of Sour Patch Kids, and you ate so much that, like, your tongue, like, was ready to bleed, right? Because you can't taste anything after that, right? That's the problem when you have a culture like that. It's not just standardized and bland. It dulls your ability to taste the things that are really real and appreciate it. Like, same way that, like, and I'm not trying to be too hipster on this, but, like, if you had real strawberries, freshly picked, small and red and delicious, right? Or apples. This is Washington, right? A real apple off a tree, as opposed to, like, the sort of mealy thing that you get in, like, late March or something like that, that's, like, it's meant to be, like, a Red Delicious. Who actually likes, the fruit industry's after me now, too. I mean, who actually likes a Red Delicious? It looks good, it packages well, it fits into a shipping container well, but I would love much more the oddly, weirdly shaped, non-standardized apple fresh off a tree, right? So, sorry, back to Tolkien, right? So Tolkien's talking about Robert Browning's The Pied Piper. He does not like Robert Browning. I don't know if any of you still read Robert Browning, but anyway, he says, "I am sorry about The Pied Piper. I loathe it. God help the children. I would as soon give them crude and vulgar plastic toys." Gosh, like, it's all around us today. "Which, of course, they will play with to the ruin of their taste. Terrible presage of the most vulgar elements in Disney, period." So this is what Tolkien thinks of Disney. And for time's sake, I can't go much longer, but please, we can talk about it later. Ask me. But I do not want to leave us on a sour or dispirited note. Instead, I should like to turn to a one passage of Tolkien where he talks about the good possibility of living in Catholic culture and secular culture at the same time. Like you UW students, a few years ago, there was a popular book by Rod Dreher called The Benedict Option and a slew of attendant books that discussed the need in the present secular culture to withdraw and build intentional Catholic communities. Tolkien would firmly disagree. And he says so. "There are dangers, of course, but a church militant cannot afford to shut up all the soldiers in a fortress. It had as bad effects on the Maginot Line. I owe a great deal, and perhaps even the church a little, to being treated, surprisingly for the time, in a more rational way. Father Francis obtained permission for me to retain my scholarship at King Edward's School and continued there. And so I had the advantage of a then first-rate school and that of a good Catholic home. Virtually a junior inmate of the Oratory House, which contained many learned fathers, largely converts, observance of religion was strict. Hilary and I were supposed to, and usually did, serve Mass before getting on our bikes to go to school in New Street. So I grew up in a two-front state, symbolizable by the Oratorian Italian pronunciation of Latin and the strictly philological pronunciation of that time introduced into our Cambridge-dominated school. I was even allowed to attend the headmaster's classes on the New Testament in Greek. I certainly took no harm and was better equipped ultimately to make my way in a non-Catholic professional society." And this is, I think this is really important that, like, for you guys here at a state school, if you're looking to build up a Christian culture, right? you should not be afraid of the culture of the school. Your school does many things really, really well, right? You don't need the church to go out there and necessarily build your biology lab or your computer science lab or your physics department, right? Let the church do really, really well what it does really, really well, and take the good from, you know, again, like to those of you who reading Exodus, right? To take the gold from Egypt, right? That is this idea of you can have both. And in reality, when you think about the circumstances of Tolkien's life when he was orphaned and the raising both in like a secular English school, right? And in the Oratorian Catholic environment home, he is much closer to you students at state universities who are getting the excellent education that a state university can provide. The problem and the hope I have for all of you is to not create a dichotomy between those two worlds, to not live with your heart in a culture that's in the chapel and your head in a culture that is in the university, right? That you need to be integrated persons. And so going back to the ultimate question that I asked in the beginning, can you be both, right? Can you be both part of Catholic culture and can you be part of American culture? Can you be part of Seattle culture? Can you be part of, you know, University of Washington culture? Can you be a Husky and be a Catholic, right? That seems like an absurd question. Of course, right? Of course you can. And Tolkien's exactly the person to be the patron for all of you in that endeavor. He's not the reserve for the uber Catholic hideaways, right? Tolkien is out there engaging with people who are in other cultures, firmly grounded in his own culture, so he has the strength to present that. But again, think of like the context in which we know Tolkien, right? Of meeting together with Charles Williams and C.S. Lewis and the rest of the Inklings, right? He's part of a small Catholic faction there, right? He has a home base. He knows his culture. He's grounded in it. He knows that that culture is an eternal culture. But at the same time, he's engaged in it today. I mean, this wonderful way he says it, right? That ultimately, he was better equipped to make his way in a non-Catholic professional society. And that's just the reality of the world that we live in 2024 in America. So as you are looking to build up Catholic culture, it's not so much like building up a cult, right? And putting yourself behind a chain fence, right? It's about building a community of people, of handing on a living tradition, of not just like going back to the mustard seed, but finding the tree, right? And seeing the relation to that tree in everything.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.